Wisconsin, a critical battleground state.
The battleground state of Wisconsin.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session.
So let's talk about Wisconsin.
This is Swing State of the Union, a podcast all about Wisconsin and why it's so important to U.S. politics. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Sam Woods. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, we're exploring a contentious moment in Wisconsin history, Act 10. It's an early example of the state Supreme Court being used to decide political disputes, which continue today in a deeply divided state. We'll look at how the law was passed and how the fight over Act 10 continues.
There are conflicting accounts of what happened in the office of Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. It was the evening of June 13, 2011, when five of the other justices appeared at her office. They were in the middle of deciding the fate of Act 10, a bill that would strip public employee unions of many of their rights. It divided communities along partisan and ideological lines. The court was no different.
Tensions were high in communities across Wisconsin during the fight over Act 10, and the mood in Justice Bradley's office reflected that. The evening turned ugly. No one disputes that Justice David Prosser put his hands squarely around Justice Bradley's neck, but why that happened, that's another story. For then-Senate Majority Leader Dale Schultz, the incident was just another stitch in the dismal tapestry of Act 10's passage.
The impression I got was not so much about either one of them, but about the inevitable result of the process not being deliberative, but the pressure was enormous. And I saw them as victims of what had become of an important issue in Wisconsin being pushed to the nth degree.
So how did we get to a place where these justices were literally at each other's throats?
It was earlier that year in 2011. Former Milwaukee County Executive Republican Scott Walker had just won the governorship in Wisconsin. By this point, Republican Senator Dale Schultz had been in the legislature for 28 years. After years of the legislature being pretty evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, Republicans won surprisingly large majorities.
We had won an election that we didn't expect to win as resoundingly as we had. And, you know, people were anxious to help Scott Walker, who was certainly not as well known as many gubernatorial candidates. He didn't do much legislating when he was in the legislature. I think he was relatively well known in the assembly, but he wasn't a mover or shaker.
But that was about to change. Governor Walker had big plans for Wisconsin and some big challenges to overcome. The state was facing a fiscal crisis, and the governor felt that he had to make some tough choices. Walker says the state had a $3.6 billion budget deficit.
You know, you could lay off tens of thousands of public employees, but even though I wanted a smaller, more effective government, I didn't want to do it through random pink slips. We could have cut Medicaid, but again, I wanted to be more strategic. I thought it made sense to make changes to encourage childless working age adults to move into the workforce and get off of Medicaid, but we didn't want to cut $3.6 billion because that would clearly cut seniors, needy families, children, and so forth. And we didn't want to raise taxes by $3.6 billion, in part because I said I wasn't going to raise taxes, but also because at that time, as bad as the economy was, we knew a massive tax increase would be like a wet blanket in any kind of recovery.
On the campaign trail, Walker had been clear that he wasn't going to raise taxes, but he was less clear about his plan to make up the difference in the budget. J.R. Ross from WisPolitics.com covered the campaign in 2010. He notes that Wisconsin's fiscal problems at the time mirrored what we saw around the nation during the Great Recession. But the state also had unique issues that Walker had some experience with as a county leader.
And Walker kind of was this figure who rose up from a backbencher in the assembly caucus when he was in the assembly, in the legislature, won in 02 in this county executive's race when the county government was in a bit of a free fall because of these giant pension payouts that they had. He mapped that into a platform to run for governor. And he was kind of campaigning the idea he was going to make state employees pay more for their health care and insurance. Walker, though, didn't explicitly say, I'm going to go after collective bargaining. And then once he got in office, that became one of the first big moves to rein the cost.
Act 10 wasn't just asking public sector workers to pay more for their benefits. It also would drastically limit collective bargaining. The bill would strip unions of many of their rights. It would repeal the right to strike for most public employees, and they would no longer be able to negotiate for raises beyond cost of living increases. The bill was 46 pages long and a far-reaching effort to scale back public unions' powers. It was a big swing, and a surprising one for veteran Republican politicians like Dale Schultz. He says the announcement of Act 10 took him off guard, but it was the way that Walker presented it to his colleagues in the Senate that really rubbed Schultz the wrong way. Schultz describes that day on the Senate floor when Walker announced the plan.
He was in the room shortly afterwards, and I think they knew there was some pushback. And so it's turned into a little bit of a show. We know he's coming. All of a sudden they announce he's here, the doors pop open, and he walks in triumphantly and tells everybody how much he needs him and we can do this, and then boom, he's out the door. It really wasn't conducive to an intelligent discussion of what was in front of us. And there's a reason why legislatures are deliberative, because you want to make the right decisions. You want the public to be engaged with you as you determine what it is that will benefit the general welfare and well-being of the people you represent. And when that happens and you're expected to be on board, that doesn't really happen. And if it had been an issue during the campaign, I think people could have said, well, it was a major part of the campaign, but it wasn't.
The protests started almost immediately. Thousands of people filled the Capitol carrying signs and chanting.
For journalist Patrick Marley and Jason Stein, who were covering state politics, these crowds became an omnipresent part of their daily lives. The two wrote a book about that time called More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. The book details the many chaotic events that came to define the passage of Act 10. They describe what it was like. We'll hear from Stein first.
Our office at the time in the Capitol Rotunda, the Capitol Press Room, had a door that opened out into the rotunda. So, you know, we had that door closed at all times, but the chanting and the shouting and the drumming and in the rotunda was so loud that if you were on the phone in the press room, the other person on the other end of the line would always be able to hear that. You would be trying to just walk from the office to the bathroom and there would be people sleeping on the floor. Or, you know, at times in the early days before the police had restored more order, there would be so many people in the Capitol that you couldn't pick your way through them hardly.
It was almost like a packed rock concert that you couldn't just, you know, walk from the assembly chamber to the Senate chamber. You had to navigate through a sea of people. And if you were a protester or a reporter, you could squeeze through pretty easily. If you were a Republican lawmaker or a staffer, the crowd was not too happy to see you, and you could get sort of trapped in a corner of the Capitol and have to retreat into your office.
Then Senator Schultz experienced that firsthand at a pivotal moment in the fight over Act 10. He had been skeptical about the act from the beginning, and his vote was crucial to getting it out of committee and to the floor of the Senate. Before that key vote, Governor Walker asked Schultz to meet at his office.
As we got closer to a vote, I did go to see him at his request. When I came back, a vote had occurred which advanced the bill. And unfortunately, there wasn't much I could do about it at that point. The building was filled with people and I had to be escorted down back stairs, down into the basement, and then up into the east wing. It just wasn't possible to freely walk quickly from one wing to the other in the Capitol.
When Schultz was finally able to get back to the Senate, the vote to advance Act 10 was over.
For his part, Governor Walker says the timing of the meeting wasn't deliberate. Although he says he has difficulty remembering the meeting, he remembers Schultz's reticence towards Act 10.
I remember in that first caucus, he was the one who was not at all interested in pursuing the ideas that we had and made it clear pretty much from that point forward. So we talked with him and other leaders along the way. But in terms of the timing of that, I had to go back and look at a calendar.
But the die had been cast. Act 10 was headed for a vote before the full Senate, and the chaos continued inside and outside the Capitol. After nearly three decades in the Wisconsin legislature, Senator Schultz found himself losing faith in his party.
Looking out of the majority leader's office one day, I was watching my colleagues running in, turning TVs from one station to another to see how this all was being covered like it was a performative art. Other people being deeply moved and wanting to pray in the next room. And all I could think of at that moment was, you know, I'm not sure God's going to be on our side in this.
Most lawmakers in Schultz's party supported Act 10. And given the Republican majorities in the legislature, Act 10 was basically guaranteed to pass. And it did. The protests eventually dissipated, but the division remained in the legislature, among residents, and even in the courts. When asked about his role in this division, Governor Walker places blame on the opponents of Act 10.
So our role, did we play a role? Sure, in the sense that we put forth a legitimate public policy solution that people then so vehemently disagreed with. They stormed the Capitol, they took it over. They then tried to recall state lawmakers.
When it comes to figuring out who's to blame for hyperpolarization, it's clear Walker doesn't believe the buck stops with him.
And here's where the Wisconsin Supreme Court comes in. Almost immediately after it was passed, Act 10 was challenged in the courts. Journalist Patrick Marley explains.
There was a lot of litigation. It lasted years, but it all began, or most of it began, right away. You know, there were different legal theories. There were different venues that these were filed in. But it was clear that Democrats and unions saw that they were probably going to lose legislatively and politically because of the Republican control of the state house, and that their only hope was in the courts.
It was the start of something new, according to journalist Jason Stein. The political fighting quickly moved from legislative chambers to the courts chambers.
You know, they started, they were in state court, they were in federal court, and in some ways they've never fully ended. I mean, there's always been people looking to litigate and relitigate that issue. And it sort of, to me, kind of helped usher in an era of two things. One, of using the courts not to settle legal disputes so much as political disputes. In other words, because you couldn't reach a consensus in the legislative realm, you tried to essentially do politics in the courts, so to speak. And then two, to me, it's been the era of nothing ever ends. So, you know, I feel like in the 2000s and the aughts, you would have political disputes and you would like whether or not, let's say, to raise the cigarette tax in the state, and you would have a fight and a debate over it, and eventually you would have a legislative bill, maybe even a bipartisan bill, and it would pass and the change would stick and you'd move on to some other fight. Whereas I feel like Act 10 ushered in an era where nothing is ever settled. One side gets a provisional, a temporary, a marginal victory on an issue, but everybody understands that as soon as power changes hands, that original action is going to be undone. And there's not a lot of certainty about what the government policy is going to be for the long term.
Politicians and political interest groups in Wisconsin have continued to use the Supreme Court to decide political disputes over abortion, gerrymandering, and power in government. Since the passage of Act 10, union membership in Wisconsin has been cut in half. Total compensation for public school teachers has dropped by 20%, and partisan polarization has continued to rise.
And after more than a decade, the law still isn't settled. We'll take a short break, then learn more about the legal fights over Act 10 and where it stands today. If you're enjoying WUWM's Swing State of the Union, please share it with a friend. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Three months after Act 10 was signed into law, the Wisconsin Supreme Court was set to make a decision. The court had to decide whether the process leading to the passage of Act 10 violated Wisconsin's open meetings law. Internally, the justices knew it would be an ideologically split decision, with the court's four conservative-leaning justices voting to uphold Act 10 and the three liberal-leaning justices dissenting.
But as afternoon turned to evening on June 13, 2011, the conservative-leaning justices were getting impatient waiting for liberal-leaning justices to file their dissent. They visited Justices Shirley Abrahamson and Ann Walsh Bradley to remind them of the deadline and threatened to announce the decision without including their dissent. But this visit would turn to violence, as reporter Patrick Marley explains.
As they got into a very heated argument, Justice David Prosser, who was in the conservative majority, put out his hands onto the neck of one of the liberal justices, Ann Walsh Bradley, and that caused, you know, ultimately this getting reported to police. This all became public, and like so much in politics at the time, became instantly polarized, with many Republicans siding with Prosser and saying that it was just a mistake, that he hadn't meant to do anything, but he had put his hands out and inadvertently touched her neck, and her saying that she was, you know, being put in a chokehold, as she described it, and Democrats rallying to her, saying this was behavior that was just absolutely unbecoming of a justice, and that he needed to face, you know, either criminal punishment for that or judicial ethics punishment for that. The law enforcement never issued any charges.
Prosser did not deny that he put his hands around Bradley's neck, and this was not the first time he was flagged for abusive behavior behind the court's doors.
According to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's testimony after the incident, she had sent an email to other justices more than a year prior regarding Justice Prosser about his, quote, abusive temper tantrums. Less than 3 months before the incident, Bradley and Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson began locking themselves in their offices when working alone, at the advice of the Deputy Director of State Courts and Law Enforcement, in response to Prosser's behavior becoming, quote, increasingly agitated. Although six of the seven justices were in the room, accounts of this incident between Bradley and Prosser contradicted each other, with conservative-leaning justices backing Prosser's account and liberal-leaning justices backing Bradley's. Some testimony, particularly that of conservative Justice Michael Gableman, didn't line up with verifiable fact. Gableman told police that Prosser was looking up at Bradley and that he believes, quote, Justice Bradley is a little bit taller than Justice Prosser. Ann Walsh Bradley is 6 inches shorter than the late David Prosser.
But as journalist Patrick Marley explains, whether Prosser faced any consequences was up to Wisconsin Supreme Court justices who enforced their own ethics procedures.
Prosser could not participate in the case because he was the accused, and he started filing motions telling others that they could not participate in the case. And within, I mean, maybe it took weeks, but over a period of time, justices increasingly dropped out of the case to the point that you didn't have enough to sit in judgment of the case.
For Marley, this is an example of how the Wisconsin Supreme Court plays by different rules than lower courts.
You know, if any other judge at any other level of court had done this, it would have surely gone to the state Supreme Court for a decision one way or the other. If any lawyer had done this, it would have gone to the state Supreme Court for them to consider it under the sort of parallel ethics rules for lawyers. But because he was a member of the court and the justices themselves had either participated in this event or witnessed it themselves, it never got decided.
In the next episode, we'll return to the question of judicial ethics and outline how justices are allowed to police themselves. But while this incident was notably violent and high profile, coming at a time when partisan tensions were high across the state, it's part of a larger trend of relationships between justices becoming more contentious. Barry Burden, director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, explains how justices have behaved in ways that create a toxic work environment.
You know, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but the signals we get on the surface are that the justices don't get along and don't trust one another, and that they take advantage of their sometimes institutional powers to poke each other in the eye. So whether it's, you know, resources that are allocated to the court system or who's hired as a clerk to run the court, the timing, the scheduling of cases, that was a dispute some years ago. Even I think what platform is used to keep track of cases, there was an argument about that. How the Chief Justice is selected, that was changed. All of the things that the justices have any power over seem to have become points of contention.
Despite all this, the court continues to rule on important matters in Wisconsin politics. Since the state Supreme Court upheld Act 10 in 2011, the law has been challenged in Wisconsin courts and federal courts repeatedly. Each time, challenges to the law have been blocked, and Act 10 has stood unscathed. Burden explains.
There were groups, especially unions, mostly unions, who filed suit against various provisions in the law. One of the provisions was limiting the ability to collect dues from workers in their workplace as part of the paycheck process. There were other rules about how unions have to recertify. It became more difficult to do that, to get the votes to keep the union in place. There were rules that treated some public sector unions, fire and police, differently from other public sector unions like nurses and teachers and government workers. All of those things were litigated. There were lawsuits in federal court. There were lawsuits in state court. Some of them went to the state Supreme Court. And it took years for those things to work their way through the process. And Act 10 survived essentially all of them. Sometimes there were judges who ruled in favor of the liberal plaintiffs who were challenging the law, but then it would be appealed and those things undone. So in the end, essentially all of Act 10 stood in place. And, you know, that's even after Walker has left office. It looked like it was going to be a legacy of his forever.
But the fight over Act 10 isn't over.
Act 10 does not treat all public employees the same. When it was crafted, Governor Walker drew a distinction between public safety employees, which included fire and police unions, and general employees, like teachers, nurses, and conservation wardens. While general employees are subject to Act 10's rules severely restricting collective bargaining, limiting dues collection and recertification, firefighter and most police unions still enjoy full benefits. But a new challenge to Act 10 is in Wisconsin courts, arguing that this distinction ignores existing state statutes that had already defined what a public safety employee is. The lawsuit was filed after the balance of power on the Supreme Court shifted in favor of liberals, with the election of Justice Janet Protasiewicz in 2023.
Jeff Mandel is the co-founder and president of Law Forward, the organization that brought this challenge to court. He explains why he believes former Governor Scott Walker's distinction between types of employees is unconstitutional under Wisconsin's Constitution.
We have in our Constitution a guarantee that all citizens get equal protection under the law, that we all get treated fairly. Doesn't mean we all get treated the same, but we all get treated fairly. And if the government is going to treat us differently, it has to do so for a rational reason. And there is no rational reason why the state highway patrol and state police and local police and firefighters are public safety workers under Act 10, but the Capitol Police are general workers. And the UW police and the conservation wardens, who just like the state police carry guns and have arrest powers and all of those things, they're general employee workers. And the only reason that those unions got categorized that way is political. And so the case says you can't do that.
This is not the first time Act 10 has been challenged on the grounds of equal protection. However, the previous equal protection challenge argued that Walker's distinction between public safety and general employees violated the U.S. Constitution. The current challenge is based on Wisconsin's Constitution. Mandel explains how this is an example of the kinds of cases coming before state courts across the nation.
It's only in the last few years there's been a lot of talk about using state constitutions and bringing litigation under state constitutions separate from the federal constitution. It's not a new idea, but it is an idea that's sort of newly being put into practice. And so as we developed this idea, it really seemed like the right moment. It was a match of what was happening in the courts with what was happening on the ground and taking a new look at Act 10. And so that's what brought this to the fore now.
Looking back to when he was crafting Act 10, Governor Walker said he wanted to exempt public safety employees from union restrictions, not because he believed they deserved special treatment, but out of fear of what would happen if they went on strike.
Our worry was in a worst-case scenario, if not all, but a significant number of those jurisdictions had either a full-out walk-off or a work shortage or a certain number of people not showing up. The last thing we wanted in this debate, in this discussion, was to have a serious public safety risk with law enforcement or to have people deal with engines not coming from a certain fire station or things of that nature. So it was just a very practical issue in terms of fire and police protection, and that's why we provided the exemption.
But 14 years later, with the immediate threat of fire and police strikes not as daunting, Walker told us that he believes these employees should be subject to Act 10's rules regarding other unions. In other words, public safety employees in fire and police unions should not have their current collective bargaining rights.
In terms of today, you know, if I had a magic wand, if I could get the current governor and legislature to change, I don't think it would be a problem for fire and police to be included today. Again, we didn't at the time for those practical reasons, but I wouldn't have any problem if they included them now, because I think, again, we don't prohibit people from being a part of the union. And I think those two entities, many of them might choose jurisdiction by jurisdiction to still be a part of the union. But it would be like we see with other public servants across the state.
If Law Forward's challenge against Act 10 is successful, collective bargaining rights for all public sector unions would be restored. Mandel explains.
That distinction between general workers and public safety workers would be stricken from the law. And so the reality is everyone would go back to the pre-Act 10 law of having the same protections that essentially our public safety workers have still enjoyed over the last decade and a half.
It's unclear exactly when the Wisconsin Supreme Court will debate Act 10's future. As of spring 2025, the case is in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, one level lower than the Supreme Court. It could take more than a year for this case to reach the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Justice Brian Hagedorn, who previously worked as Walker's legal counsel and helped write Act 10, has already recused himself from hearing challenges to the law. But whether or not Act 10 remains, it has set the tone for partisan politics in Wisconsin and on the state Supreme Court for the foreseeable future.
On the next episode of Swing State of the Union, we dig into the effect money has had on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We look at the ethics rules for justices and how a case of child lead paint poisoning led to the most expensive state court race in U.S. history.
They calculated that it was cheaper to buy a Supreme Court than it was to buy the legislature every two years, which is to say that the money that they wanted to spend to influence policy, you're spending on one Supreme Court election a year rather than 50 seats in the Assembly and 33 seats in the Senate.
Ethics v. Money. Next time on Swing State of the Union. I'm Sam Woods.
And I'm Joy Powers. Swing State of the Union is produced by WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, a part of the NPR network. Please subscribe to the Swing State of the Union podcast wherever you like to listen.